from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out what it will take to be the new music director for the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra.
I'll chat with the IMA's curator of audience experiences and performances, Scott Stulen.
And I'll chat with photographer Rad Drew about his new exhibit at Clues Memorial Hall, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. For the first time in a quarter of a century, the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra is looking for a music director. The list has been narrowed to three candidates, and you can hear about each one and hear each one conduct a concert this season. Sharon Gamble invited the ICO's executive director, Elaine Eckert, plus concertmaster Emily Glover and principal bassist David Murray into our studios to talk about the search process as well as the season, which begins this Friday, September 26th.
So it seems to be a very high-spirited season for the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. Elaine, explain that.
Well, we're calling it a season unlike any other because we will be having our candidates for our music director search. We are in the process of searching for a new music director to replace Maestro Trevor upon his retirement at the end of this season.
Mm-hmm.
So he will be with us all season except for these three concerts where we are bringing in the three finalists. And this represents, we are, I would say, at the midway point of the process. The total process will take 18 to 24 months. And up to this point, we have posted the job, received applications, and screened over 150 candidates from all over the world for this position. So we are thrilled with the quality of applicants. And as a result of that process, we have narrowed it down to the three candidates that will be featured at the September, November, and January concerts. And I can tell you who those candidates are if you want to know.
Sure.
Okay. They are Kelly Corcoran, who is presently with the Nashville Symphony Orchestra in an assistant or associate conductor capacity. Misha Santora, who had been with the Cincinnati Chamber Orchestra for 12 or 13 years and just recently took a position in Minnesota. Matthew Kramer, who is out on the out east conducting the Erie Chamber Orchestra and also an assistant with the Buffalo Philharmonic.
Mm-hmm.
So Matthew happens to have ties to Indiana, but that's, it's really their conducting and their music director credentials that made them really rise to the top.
Sure. We were mentioning before we turned on the microphones that in any field is really small when you get deep into it, and therefore you're happy with the quality of submissions because people know the ICO. They know people in music circles know of the quality of the orchestra. David Murray, we have two section leaders, one relatively newer to the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra, Emily Glover. David Murray, you've been how long?
Yeah, I've been here for, this is my 18th season with the orchestra.
Gosh.
I can't believe it.
And you mentioned before we turned on the mics that you happen to have connections to two of these three candidates.
That's correct. It's coincidental. I had no idea. I was not part of the search, so I had no idea who was applying. And it wasn't until the candidates were announced that I went, oh, I know two of these people. Matt Kramer was a violin student at Butler when I started there. 17 years ago, and Kelly Corcoran actually took lessons from me, bass lessons, for one semester. She did this before she got her position in Nashville, and she wanted to sort of get into string instruments a little bit more. She didn't really know anything about the bass, and so we worked for a whole semester. She's very sweet. She's very nice, very bright, very energetic. I really like her a lot. And who would know that, you know, all these years later, they would be conducting us this season as candidates for the position. So
always be friendly to fellow students and fellow faculty members, exactly. Because you never know when your paths will cross again, right? So tell us about the screening process. Emily, you've been part of the committee. Is it called a search committee? Is that what we call it?
Yes, I was in an advisory role. Mm-hmm. The process was very lengthy, very in-depth. The committee was very thorough in their review of these candidates, I think, from what I saw and what I heard, and from the suggestions that I made and the advice that I gave. It was a very, very high level, very competitive, and I think I'm really excited about seeing some new faces coming in to work with us, and it'll be a challenge, and I think I'm really excited about it.
Sure. So in addition, of course, to the orchestra members having a chance to experience these conductors, not just their style, but their rehearsal style. I suspect you learn more in rehearsal than in performance when you're working with new people.
Quite often, yeah.
Elaine, how else will they have a chance to interact in any other settings when they're here, or what's that like?
Yes, they will. And I guess this is the on-the-ground portion of the interview, if you will, for the 4 days that they will be in town. They will be in meetings with board members and with the staff. Of course, they will get to see the venue and get to know and meet some of the people, some of our partners at Butler University, because all of the concerts that the candidates will be conducting will be held at the Schrott Center for the Arts, which is our new orchestral home. And so this is the feet on the ground. I mean, this the biggest part of this part of the evaluation is the artistic, how they handle the orchestra, essentially, mm-hmm. and whether they really do make the music come alive and produce a fabulous concert. Mm-hmm. But we will see how they interact with the audience at our post-concert reception and at our pre-concert chat. We will get another glimpse at some of their written communication with their blog posts and their oral communication with radio interviews that are that week. Mm-hmm. And so there's going to be lots they're going to have a very busy 4 days meeting with staff, board, engaging with the media community, engaging with our patrons and our musicians. Prior to this time, the review, you know, first it's a review on paper with applications, and then conducting samples, video, and then there was a written portion of the evaluation, and then an interview that was done via Skype because none of the candidates were local. So those 4 steps have already happened, and then now with each person gets their 4 days with the orchestra to be kind of immersed in what we do.
Sure. That sounds like a lot of rigor involved there. Yeah.
It is, but, you know, this is a really important position.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a leadership position. It will set our direction for the next, we don't know how many years. Maestro Trevor has been with us 27 seasons, which is quite uncommon. So that's not to say that this person's going to be here for 27 years, but you know, if we do our jobs right, we will select someone who, really can carry a vision forward for the orchestra artistically for the next several years.
Mm-hmm. How are the musicians, surveyed or involved? So let's pretend it's the Monday after this weekend's concert. Is there a written survey of musicians? Are there interviews or how does that, what's that process?
There is a written survey, and there also is time during that 4-day period between rehearsals for there to be, you know, some social interaction,
sure,
with the musicians. But the real evaluation instrument, and it's a very key part of of this process is a written survey that remains confidential until the entire process is over.
Good.
So
so you can be candid.
Yes.
You guys
yes.
can say, you know, things you like, things that you're like, I'm not sure this person is a good fit because.
Exactly.
La, la, la.
And we will be. I mean, it's not just their style on the podium, but artistically what we feel that they bring out of us as a group, and also personally how we feel we relate to them, because that's really important.
You want somebody to challenge you, I guess.
We want somebody to challenge us, but not, you know, beat us up so right. that we feel belittled either. I mean, there's that side of
it. You don't want to be black and blue at the
exactly.
end of the concert. Yeah. So
there's another element in this, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No,
but
that's okay.
On each of these three programs, we have a 5 to 7 minute new work that is being composed by James Aikman, who is our composer in residence. And it's actually, these are going to be, eventually these movements will be linked into a much bigger composition that will be entitled Peacemakers, and that's the working title right now.
Mm-hmm.
The inspiration is that these various movements will are inspired by peacemakers of our time, Mandela, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, others, Mother Teresa. Jamie's got a whole list, so I told him we can't have a 72-hour piece. But, you know,
and 30 guest conductors.
Yes, yeah, and 30 guest conductors. But, you know, it will be a comprehensive work. It will not be completed in this season. It will eventually be integrated with, you know, video and maybe even other music forms like introducing chorus or dance, other performing arts. So there's a comprehensive vision for the piece, but on each of these three concerts, there will be Peacemakers 1, 2, and 3, which will be movements that will eventually be. So it gives us a chance to see how this conductor works with new music. I mean, this music is hot off the press.
Will Jamie Aikman be there in rehearsal at all?
Yes, he will.
Okay, that's interesting too.
And he's already been in conversation with Kelly on this verse, and she's got the score, and they both Emily and David just finished bowing.
That's
the
right.
Score,
so I've had a little sneak peek.
Was the repertoire for these three concerts conducted by the music director candidates? Was that repertoire set by Kirk, or was it set by the candidates, or some other process?
A combination.
Okay.
The guest artists and the concerto were selected by Kirk. And that was a matter of anchoring the season and also being able to, these finalists were not identified until shortly before we kind of had to announce our season and our dates. So we had to be able to secure dates for the venue and secure guest artists. The programs were fleshed out, the remaining repertoire. So Kelly Corcoran was told, Sean Chen will be playing Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, and she and there will be one movement of Aikman's Peacemaker.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she was given, and then she fleshed out the rest.
Okay,
and
cool.
All three of them did the same.
How many times have you done the Barber in concert before, Emily?
Never, actually.
Okay,
maybe I shouldn't be admitting that, but
no, that's great.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be doing it. When I first got the job as concertmaster, Kirk approached me and asked me what I wanted to do. He had some suggestions of things he thought that might be interesting for me to play.
Mm-hmm.
And Barber had always been one of those pieces that I had somehow neglected in my studies, yet I always loved it.
Yeah.
And it's one of these pieces that just is so gorgeous, and I think the audience will love it, hopefully.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great piece, and it's really fun to play, and I've been working on it very, very hard over the summer. So,
and I can attest, because I was on the committee that hired Emily when we did the concertmaster search, and I can attest to her high level on every aspect. It's going to be musically and technically just stunning. It's going to be wonderful. It's going to be very satisfying.
And this is something that we are very proud of in the ICO, that we have musicians who really, they are outstanding in their ensemble playing, but they really are soloists in their own right. And, I mean, we featured other ICO principals, Ellie Ebon, David Murray, who's sitting right here, Leanna Boos, and now Emily, and this is her second full year as concertmaster, so this is her moment to shine.
Sharon Gamble with Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra Executive Director Elaine Eckhart, Concertmaster Emily Glover, and Principal Bassist David Murray. Learn more about the three music director candidates, the ICO season, and their educational outreach, too, at icomusic.org. Again, icomusic.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Last spring, the Indianapolis Museum of Art hired Scott Stulen to be the museum's first ever curator of audience experiences and performance. Created by IMA Director and CEO Charles Venable, the position, quote, will develop a strategic vision for innovative public programming, unquote, in the museum's galleries, theaters, and nature park. Stulen comes to the IMA from the Walker Art Center, where he was the project director for MNArtists.org and in charge of curating and producing the world-famous first-ever Internet Cat Video Festival. Travis DiNicola spoke with Scott about his new position.
You have a great title at the IMA, Curator of Audience Experiences and Performance. You're the first person to hold this title. Let me just ask you, what does that title mean?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, I think I'm the only person in the country that has that title thus far. But I think that's actually changing. So I think it's the IMA kind of acknowledging that audiences are changing and also kind of, you know, curation is changing. And so is the role of public programs and education inside the museum. So this title is somewhat reflective of work that I've done before this. But what it kind of means in the context of the IMA is that taking things like public programs, events, performance works, so that can be dance, film, music, and kind of elevating it to the point of a curatorial position within the museum. And while that, you know, contemporary museums often have a performing arts curator, encyclopedic museums rarely do. And I think the difference with this is actually saying not only that that type of performative work, but saying things that are dealing with audience experience, so how audiences engage the galleries, things that happen that are kind of the relationships between the collection and audiences is also a curatorial practice.
So this would include events, activities, experiences that connect with existing shows, exhibits, works, but it does also go beyond that as well. I mean, it seems like it's sort of a two-part job in some ways, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's probably about a 10-part job. but it does that. So it does. It's obviously connecting to things that are already existing. So the collection of the IMA, shows that are coming into the museum, shows that other curators are working on. But it's also to try to connect to the campus, so things that are happening throughout the whole campus, thinking of that very holistically, and also developing new programs to kind of take advantage of spaces and venues on the campus, new programs that are standalone, that are kind of their own kind of curatorial event, per se. And then I will also be curating shows, too. So it'll be kind of a mix of all of those things.
Now, you did similar work at the Walker Art Center, correct?
I did.
In Minneapolis. Tell me a little bit about that job and some of the highlights from that experience.
Sure. And I think, you know, I have kind of an interesting background. So I actually come from a studio art background. So my degrees are actually in painting and drawing and in art history. My graduate degrees in painting and drawing and art history. So I kind of fell into the museum career. I think as a lot of, I think often particularly contemporary curators kind of come at it maybe at a different angles. And as I was working on my studio work, I got a job in a museum in Rochester, Minnesota. And I did public programs there, and shortly thereafter became the associate curator there. So I was able to, in a small museum, do a lot of different things. So everything from videographer to drywall installer to curator. but you really learned a lot from that. And then from there, I moved to the Walker. And at the Walker, my formal title was project director for MNArtists.org, so, which was an online kind of artist resource for Midwest artists. We employed about 85 writers that wrote arts criticism and long form essays for the site, and then also had a database of artists within the Midwest. So that project, I kind of was able to turn it into more.
A little bit more.
And worked very closely with the Public Programs Education Department at the Walker to develop a project called Open Field. And my colleague Sarah Schultz and I worked on that, and that basically took an open field adjacent to the museum and turned it into a programming platform. And what was different about that is we not only programmed it ourselves, invited artists in for residencies, but we also invited the public to come and program it with us, and we meant it. So over the course of three summers, we had 350 different projects occur on that space, and really experimental things, things that the museum would have a difficult time housing within its walls, and
sure.
really trying to challenge that, a little bit of that tension between the inside and the outside, between different types of curation, between the museum, about what's sanctioned, what isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But really a lot of it was about kind of thinking about how artists are working more collaboratively, more interactively, how that relationship between artists, institution, audience has become very gray. And I think very interesting because of that.
You know, looking at the role of the museum and how the role of the museum has changed so much from being just this this physical location that protects and shows physical artworks. Art has changed, obviously, so much. And so, you know, museums have had to sort of change to accommodate, you know, performance art, installation art, you know, things that are very temporary in their construction. But it's more than that, it seems. It's more than just reacting to the changes in art the way the museum has changed.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, you're correct. I mean, artists are changing, but this has been happening back to Fluxus and beyond that. So
yeah.
There's always been artists kind of working in that performative realm. But I think, you know, you could talk about the ways the gallery structure is changing and kind of the economics of things are changing, which I think is somewhat true. Also, kind of artists that are coming out of school are embracing different practices, and I think far more interdisciplinary than they have been in the past, maybe a little bit more conceptually driven as far as, like, contemporary artists. But I really think a lot of this is being driven, too, by audiences changing. So the type of experience, audiences wanting a participatory experience, want to contribute to making meaning. And I think it's also museums reacting that I believe strongly the museum's role is to make connection between artists and the work, making things relevant to your daily life, that art and life, that they are one and the same, and really making that connection relevant. And I think artists are looking at that in the same way and just viewing this type of work as being another vehicle towards that, and a very effective one. And I think it's thinking about how the experience or the event and the museum being a place where those things can happen. So one of those experiences can be looking at a painting in a traditional way. That hasn't gone away.
Right.
It's still there. But it also can be a place where you have a different type of experience. Maybe it's sitting down with another museum goer and having a conversation that was facilitated by an artist installation that was there. Something that wouldn't have, you know, you wouldn't normally think of maybe happening in a museum. But more and more artists are thinking of that being the context where those things can happen.
You know, the IMA has a great tradition of offering, I think, a lot of sort of programs beyond just showing the physical art in the museum, whether it's the movies that are shown outside, certainly events through Oldfields, you know, different parties or things that they've done on the lawn. Maybe one of the best examples is more recently the work that's being done with 100 Acres, especially when the IMA brought different artists who essentially lived on the island different times throughout the summer, and people could sort of interact with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there is that tradition there that you're inheriting. But is it fair to say, and I'm saying this as someone who loves the IMA, that maybe a lot of these experiences weren't always coordinated or connected?
I think that's very fair, and I think that's partly why my position was created in a way, is to give that a give it a unified voice, and I think my role really is as a connector. And I really think of that as not only my role at the IMA, but kind of my role as a curator and an artist is as a connector. So how do you bring these things together, create kind of a unified meaning, have things be able to be independent and kind of exist on their own, but really giving an identity?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the IMA does have a history of really, I think, progressive audience engagement programs that have come out of there. I think 100 Acres is a great example of thinking about a sculpture park in a different way. The IMA Lab is really revolutionary for how you think about online presence in the museum.
Sure.
And I think this is just another step, is thinking about audience engagement, and then this role of kind of public programs within the museum is also being cutting edge. But I think, you know, to your point, it really is about giving it a little bit more of a structure, an identity. It feels less like a bunch of one-off things happening kind of randomly. And this is partly why it's a curatorial department now, is to give it a vision, give it a voice, give it kind of an identity that you kind of understand that this is the type of experience that I may expect. I hope within that there's a whole bunch of surprises, and it isn't just a one type of thing. It's a really a variety of things. And the thing I've been kind of careful to kind of caution, this doesn't mean we're going to throw out all the traditional lectures and things of that nature,
sure,
too.
Sure.
That, of course, will be there. But I think it's to think about the IMA as this kind of as a campus.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the collection, it's an experience in the gallery, but it's also walking through 100 acres. It's also coming to a film event. It's also coming and maybe being surprised because a pop-up concert happened in an elevator that you weren't expecting.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's all of those things. And my hope is really to bring people to the museum more frequently. So it isn't I come to the one exhibit that I'm interested in a year and I'll see you next year.
Right, right.
It's more that I'm going to go to the IMA on a Thursday night because last time I see something really cool happen I didn't expect and I want to not miss the next time that happens.
Right, how to make the IMA more a part of your life, your
correct.
Regular choice. Can you tell us about some of the things you're working on or give us a preview of some of the projects that
sure.
are coming up?
Sure, absolutely. So it's a lot of different things, and I kind of been calling like this first couple of months that I'm here in town is kind of taking inventory and seeing what's already here. And
sure.
And so Summer Nights is a good example of that. So you have a program that'll be 40 years old next year.
Mm-hmm.
That we've been able to kind of add programming to and kind of give it a little bit of a little more to it, kind of creating more of a program around it. So we're working on things kind of in that vein. So Winter Nights will be, again, happening this winter. And we're working around that of doing things thematically around the film. So it won't be just coming to the film. We're going to start programming 2 hours beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be trivia. It might be a band. It might be some other kind of experience related to the films. Thematically, we're thinking around the idea of soundtrack.
Okay.
For this winter. Also working on things like the 20th here of September, so for Equinox. So mm-hmm. this year's Equinox event is all around sound art. So we're actually commissioning two new pieces by local artists, so Stuart Hyatt and Brian McCutcheon.
Oh, great. Two excellent
great.
Artists.
Yes, mm-hmm. I'm really been happy to work with them. So one is going to be creating a platform out in the lake mm-hmm. that will be having underwater microphones that will be kind of played by things that are dropped into the water.
Hmm.
And then for Stuart's piece, we're trying to get 100 guitar players together to make one giant power chord, the loudest power chord we can out in the park. And then we're bringing in circuit bending artists and a whole array of things to kind of really think about kind of how you experience sound out
That's
in 100
so cool.
acres.
Huh.
We're doing different film programs, including pairing with Indie Film Fest to do Blair Witch out in the woods for Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to screen Fargo in January outside.
Nice. bring your winter coat.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We're doing an event called Silent Night in November. So it's a Saturday right after Thanksgiving when you're kind of sick of your family and sick of shopping. So it's all solitary things that are quiet in the museum. So silent headphone concerts, silent tours, silent film, meditation and yoga in the galleries. That will be open that night. And then we're working on a thing with local artists called the Monster Drawing Rally. So we're mm-hmm. going to invite artists to come and draw, and their drawings will be available for a flat fee of $35 each immediately after they're done finishing the drawings. And then moving into the next year, we're looking at a whole new series of film programs. We're looking at things like an adult summer camp where you can come mm-hmm. and actually like camp at the IMA and take part in different activities
oh,
there.
Fun.
And I think of a lot of other surprises kind of up our sleeves, too.
It sounds also like there's a lot of engagement with both local artists and other arts and cultural organizations.
Absolutely. So I think my background and my role at the Walker was a lot of kind of being the local artist wing of the institution
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
really kind of connecting with local artists. And I feel a very strong kind of personal desire to do that. And I also think it's a way that an institution like the IMA should be connecting to its community.
Mm-hmm.
It should be finding ways to support artists in a multitude of ways. Sometimes it isn't always like doing an exhibition with them, but it can
yeah.
be supporting in a lot of different ways. But I'm really interested in working with the artists here, both locally and regionally, when as much as we can. And I think also having the IMA be a place that they feel kind of supports what they do and also a place that they want to come and interact, have conversations, learn from. We should be that resource. And I think there's a way that we can, you know, from the IMA support a lot of other smaller organizations in the city, help them do what they do, gain exposure, and not like squash them as the big institution
yeah,
either,
yeah.
but really support what they're doing and find ways that we can partner and benefit each other.
Let me ask you, you've been here now about 6 months or so,
yeah, yeah.
roughly, since the spring. What is it about Indianapolis, our arts and cultural community, that excites you?
I think there's a lot of life here. I really think coming down and kind of going through the interview process and looking at the city, it feels like a city that's really on this upswing. There's, I think, a lot of creative energy. I think there's some really good existing things here, but I also see a lot of younger kind of creatives moving to the city or
mm-hmm.
staying here. All those things about kind of like new tech industry, like, you know, you have a strong kind of medical industry here. I think there's things that that brings in kind of more of this kind of creative class that I really feel is like the foundation here. But it's also going to like First Fridays and seeing what's happening down in Fountain Square and seeing these young artists kind of not waiting for something to happen, but taking charge and making something happen. Those things are really exciting to me, seeing that energy. And I think it's also looking at the IMA, too, of just this huge potential. And it isn't to say there hasn't been amazing things that have happened in the past, because there has. But there really is no place in the country that has the Encyclopedic Museum of the size and breadth of the collection there that has 150 acres of other stuff.
Right, right.
Like, it's nobody
a very
has that.
Museum, yeah.
And, I mean, everything from, I'm like, there's, it's almost overwhelming to where to start. But there's things like, you know, we have a bee colony and an apple orchard and like a community garden, and we grow hops in the greenhouse, and like I have all sorts of ideas how we can play with that.
That sounds kind of fun.
Which could be great, right?
Right.
So, and it's, so it's finding ways that we can kind of find different ways of people thinking about the campus, thinking about ways to engage. And, you know, I'm very much about kind of, I don't think of a hierarchy of audience. So it isn't if you come to see a certain show that you're, you know, higher up on the level of audience than if somebody just comes down to walk through the
right.
property. They're all valuable. It's all people that are coming to experience the museum. And it's all people that will cross over into other things if they're coming frequently enough and exposed to it. So I think it's thinking about different entry points that people have to the IMA and ways that we can kind of make the IMA valuable and meaningful to people's lives. And for some people, that is an experience outdoors.
Sure.
And thinking about how you can, you know, interact with that. And for other people, of course, it's the gallery.
Let me ask you one last question before we wrap this up, Scott. It's a real pleasure to chat with you about this.
Likewise.
Cat videos? You knew it was coming.
Of course.
you're kind of famous for putting together the first cat video festival.
That I am. My Google search is ruined forever, yes.
So I got to know first how you pitched this in the first place, and are we going to see more cat videos here?
So, very fair question. I almost got out of it. So, no, I respect what cat videos have done for my career, and I embrace it as such. Really, to answer your question, how that happened is I snuck it through. And one of the things I like to say in this kind of line of work, particularly kind of what I do, it's a little bit untraditional, is that sometimes it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission. This was one of those cases. and my boss at the Walker, Sarah Schultz, was very supportive of it. She knew of it, but it was something that we were very strategic about, not letting it out too far before it was kind of too late.
Not letting the cat out of the bag?
I didn't let the other curators know it was coming. So that isn't to set a precedent here that anybody should be worried about. But really with that, and we had no idea to be the scale that it was. And I mean, I really thought when we originally thought of this kind of novel idea, 50 people might show up, love a case of beer, it'll be fun, we'll go home. But really within, you know, strategically we dropped the press release and I kind of had some places to get it out in the world. But Gawker picked it up in 2 hours and I was on the phone with the LA Times within 3 hours after publishing the blog post that we're going to do it. So then it became this kind of novelty, of course, the high art museum doing the cat video thing.
Right.
And then 10,000 people showed up for the first one, and the story shifted.
That's just so incredible.
Like, you know, what's going on?
Yeah.
And then over the course of the last, you know, 2 years, it's been in 75 different cities now, eight
That's
different
so cool.
countries.
Yeah.
And I've spoken at everything from IFP's festival in New York to South by Southwest twice to it's become this, like, this thing. And I think what's interesting about it, though, and kind of conclude the question about coming to the IMA. Will we do cat videos there? I'm not sure. I've got, I think, other ideas, I hope, than that. But I think the premise behind it of taking something, of bringing people together over something that they're passionate about and something maybe unexpected is definitely at the core of the work that I do. And I think that's something that through the Cat Video Festival, it allowed me to talk to tens of thousands of people around the world about contemporary art, about different types of audience engagement, about the museum. And that's an audience that normally, if I said I want to talk to you about art, would never listen to me.
But you were able to engage them?
It's the vehicle. So.
Okay, one last question. Do you have any cats yourself?
I don't. My family's allergic. So it's the irony of all of it, right? I've used cats.
Travis DiNicola with the IMA's Curator of Audience Experiences and Performances, Scott Stulen. You can learn more about what Scott is doing at the IMA at imamuseum.org, imamuseum.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
September 25th is a special day because...
it's the Art of the Matter birthday.
It is. 15. We're 15.
Happy birthday.
Not quite legal. And we have a very brief calendar to celebrate on...
What'll we do? Well, I'm just going to give you a heads up on the new music series, the Jazz Concert Series at Eskenazi Health. On Thursday, October 2nd, the American Pianists Association Jazz Concert Series is beginning Eskenazi Health in the Marianne Tobias Music Program. And they're going to have some great musicians performing there throughout the year. The first concert is going to feature Christian Sands of New York City, who's a Grammy Award nominated pianist, and lots of other musicians will be performing throughout the year. This first performance is at 4:30 p.m.
So, coming up at Clues Hall in mid-October, Jay Leno and Kevin Eubanks, but as part of the Clues Conversations, these wonderful little previews, a talk on Tuesday, September 30th at 7:30 at Clues Hall is A Guy Walks Into a Bar, How to Tell a Joke.
Nice.
Teaching artist John Colby, who teaches in Fishers and has had a career that has spanned Second City, Improv Olympic, and The Playground, will teach you some techniques and you'll walk out knowing how to tell a joke.
Excellent.
Love it. Hey,
you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. And we'll have more for you next week on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Photographer Rad Drew loves using digital, mirrorless, and iPhone cameras to capture the light and soul of places and people. His work has been in juried international competitions and exhibitions from California to Australia, and he's published two fine art books, In Good Light, Images of the Circle City, and Rural Indiana, A Beauty All Its Own. Rad's new exhibition is called Cuba, Rural U.S., Indiana, an eclectic exhibition. It will be on view at Clues Memorial Hall through October 26th. Sharon Gamble spoke with Rad about his work.
So if the name Rad Drew sounds familiar, it's because you might have heard him on The Art of the Matter recently with a different hat on, with your hat as judge of the mobile phone competition that was held at the JCC recently.
Yep.
But now you have an exhibit of your own work that's just opened at Clues Hall on Butler's campus. And I love that the sort of description of this is Cuba, Rural U.S., Indiana, an eclectic exhibition. So why these particular subject matters together?
Well, Sharon, this exhibit is the culmination of at least 3 years of photography that I've done. Much of it with the iPhone, which I discovered in 2010 as a camera. And because it's such a large show, I have nearly 100 images that will be exhibited. It wasn't possible to have a single theme. So it's eclectic in that it will be curated in such a way that it will make sense in terms of groupings of images. But it's really almost like several exhibits rolled into one.
Mm-hmm.
And it does feature, I'd say probably 85% of it is iPhone images that were photographed and processed on the iPhone, and the remaining images with other cameras, other DSLR or mirrorless cameras that I also shoot with.
You mentioned before we turned the microphones on that you have a number of photographer friends who've been traveling the world and finding exotic places to shoot, and that while you maintain a day job and maybe aren't traveling quite that much right now, you've found plenty of inspiration literally in your and figuratively in your own backyard.
Well, it's true, I have. And yes, many of the photographers that I kind of hang out with online or have met and know in person, Many of them travel the world to exotic places to photograph, or they lead tours to those places and so forth. And I've gone to some of those places myself, but most of the time I shoot here. And I grew up in Indiana, in southern Indiana along the Ohio River, so I love rural Indiana. I think it's one of the most beautiful places in the country. And then in Indianapolis, I've been here 23 years. And if one walks around the city, you can find all kinds of opportunities for extraordinary architecture, historic neighborhoods. We've got Fall Creek and the White River running right through the city. It's unique in that way to many cities. So it's been a pleasure for me to photograph here. And several years ago, I created a book, Images of the Circle City, In Good Light, Images of the Circle City. And it was sort of my answer to all of my friends who travel the world. I wanted to show them that I lived in a beautiful part of the world, too.
Absolutely. And we are not only long on beauty, we're long on quirk. We have some eccentric places, and the fact that we're having our conversation at lunchtime might show in the ones I'm about to mention. Barbecue Heaven, which is this fabulous barbecue place over on MLK Drive.
Yes.
And there's a wonderful photo in this book also of Iria's on the near south side, that great old family-run Italian restaurant. They look like they could be, you know, they could be anywhere in the world.
Well, and that's exactly right. And part of what I enjoy doing this is photographing those places and then processing them in a way that gives them sort of a timeless quality. I love places like Aria. I can stand there or be in the bar there and feel like I'm in New York City or
absolutely.
Somewhere.
Absolutely. All that old neon and glass block.
Yep,
and
exactly.
The people who've probably been coming there for decades.
Yep, yep.
Talk about some of the tools that are available for use in is it still called post-processing? I don't know.
Yes. And post-processing is just a photography term that means, you know, what do you do to the picture after you take it?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of photographers today in digital world, they'll take their pictures and they'll go sit at their computer and they'll put them in Photoshop. And they mm-hmm. might sharpen them or enhance the color or do a host of different things. Well, with the phone, you're still taking a digital image and the phone is still fundamentally a camera. So all of the things that you would look for in any photograph, you would look for, you know, you would look for composition and those kinds of things that are, you know, part and parcel of a quality photograph.
Mm-hmm.
But then what you can do with applications that are available for the phone, and there are a host of them, you can enhance your image with color. You can make it look like a painting. You can turn an image into a sketch. You can make an image appear to be a vintage image. So many of the rural Indiana photographs that I've done, you'd be hard-pressed to distinguish them from a picture taken 60 years ago.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the fun for me. I enjoy the taking of the image, but then the fun for me comes in the processing. So you begin then to play, and you begin to explore your artistic vision for what you might want to present in that image. And as you learn the software tools available, you can begin to pull those into, oh, I want to try to get this painterly effect with this, or I want to change the sky a little bit here, or mm-hmm. those sorts of things.
Do you ever have trouble deciding and give the same treatment or the same photograph 3-4 multiple treatments?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, someone asked me today, how long does it take you to create an image like this? You know, and sometimes it takes me 10 minutes and I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
Other times it'll take me hours and I might try several different approaches or process it in several different ways before I find the result that resonates for me as what I was looking for.
And does that stay stable over time? Let me give an example for some context for the question. So the show that's just opened at Clues that has some images that you took on a trip to Cuba, how long ago was that trip?
That was in the winter of January of 2013, I believe.
Okay,
yeah.
So it's been a little while.
Yep.
So maybe you came back and you had some images the way they spoke to you in February of 2013. In the process of selecting them and getting them ready for the show, did you say, well, you know what? Maybe that's not quite right. Maybe I should go back and visit it again. Or does your vision kind of gel and tell you when it's time to leave it alone and move on?
Yeah, and that's such a great question. I think many artists, painters that I know always ask that question, when is it done?
Yeah.
And, you know, I've resisted going back. So to answer your question, it's a continual progression, I think. I'm constantly learning. The people I work with and know in this who do this work, you're constantly learning new things. There are new applications that come out that give you capability that you might not have had last year. So there are things like that. The technology is changing so rapidly that just keeping up with that. But also it's about your own internal process, bringing to your work what, you know, where you are, where's your heart in this work today? And that is constantly changing. I've resisted the temptation to go back and reprocess images that I did in 2011. And for the most part, sometimes I still do. There's such a vast number of images that I have in the queue to be processed. Going back through things is probably not, you know, it's just not something I have taken time to do.
But you do have an advantage as a photographer in the digital age over, say, a painter because, you know, yes, oil paint stays wet for a long time, but at some point it does dry.
That's true. It's very, it's different in that way, absolutely. I think that's part of the digital world does allow us some of those things. I have a background in photography and studied journalism photography at IU, photojournalism, and worked in the darkroom back then, and it was a whole different thing. You know, you developed your film, and once it was done, and you kind of didn't look back at it. And we didn't do a lot of post-processing in the journalism world. I mean, in fact, it was taboo to post-process.
Sure.
You photographed what was there, and that was it, and you didn't affect the image otherwise. And so for me, I've kind of gone to the other end of the continuum now in that I do very much a very great deal of post-processing.
If any of Rad's professors are listening, just work with it, you know, go with the flow here. the trip to Cuba, was that a vacation or was that work-related? Why Cuba?
It was a vacation, and Cuba has been a place that has fascinated me for years. And I have no real Cuba connection other than maybe watching The Godfather, one of the Godfather movies where they were there for the revolution and the exodus that many people made there. What was fascinating to me and is fascinating to me about Cuba is that it is a virtual time capsule.
Hmm.
So when you go back to Cuba, you are in an area that has kind of stopped in time. After the Bay of Pigs incident, you know, late in the, was that 59-60 era, they've been cut off from the rest of the world in many ways, other than the Soviet Union. They don't have the things that we have. The cars that they have on the street are still from the 50s.
Wow.
And so, and Cuba itself at one time was one of the most beautiful cities in the world. It rivaled, you know, places in Paris. And today, that city is, much of it is in distress. It's in decay, but it has its own beauty even in that condition. And I guess what attracted me to Cuba were all those things and wanting to go before it changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think politically right now with Castro's aging and with the changes that the Obama administration has made with Cuba,
mm-hmm.
I think we're going to start seeing more. We already are seeing some changes, but just the fact that we can go there legally now is not something we could do 5 years ago.
Absolutely.
So those changes, once that happens, I think once commerce starts, the city will change, and it needs to change. The people there suffer on a daily basis from not having what we have,
mm-hmm.
And being able to live, you know, as well as we do. And I think trade will help that. But from a photographer standpoint and from an aesthetic standpoint, it's a beautiful place to go and see. And the people are extraordinary in terms of welcoming and just being a wonderful people, innovative and colorful and beautiful.
Do you think of yourself as a storyteller?
Well, you know, I guess maybe. Maybe not so much consciously, but I think, you know, you hear photographers talk about an image needing to tell a story. And the better photographs that you see are ones that intrigue you in some way, that pull you in, that create a mystery, or, you know, the juxtaposition of elements in the photograph bring someone into it in a way that it may tell a story, or it may influence someone to create their own story about what they see. So I guess in that case, maybe I am a storyteller.
Sharon Gamble with photographer Rad Drew, whose new exhibition is called Cuba, Rural U.S., Indiana, an eclectic exhibition. It will be on view at Clues Memorial Hall through October 26th, and you can attend a gallery tour on Tuesday, September 30th at 6 p.m. with Rad. If you're interested in having Rad create a personal tour for your group, call 317-506-9901. Again, 317-506-9901. And you can learn more about cluesHall.org and Rad at raddrewphotography.com. Again, that's clueshall.org or raddrewphotography.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll find out about this year's Arts for Learning Chocolate Fest.
I'll have a look at the upcoming Indie Baroque Orchestra season.
And I'll chat with Christopher West and Jonathan Nessie about the design installation they're creating in Columbus, Indiana. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.